This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Just before the end of the year, Governor Shumlin came to a conclusion about single-payer health care that shocked some and brought joy to others in the state.
In my judgment, now is not the right time to ask our legislature to take the step of passing a financial plan for Green Mountain health care. The bottom line is, as we completed the financing modeling in the last several days, it became clear that the risk of economic shock is too high at this time to offer a plan that I can responsibly support for passage in the legislature.
The financial component was a key responsibility of the Green Mountain Care Board. The board was created as part of Act 48 in 2011. That act spelled out the governor's plan to move towards a single-payer health system that the board would help oversee. But did Shumlin's decision spell the end for the board? No, says our guest today. There's more work to be done. Al Gobay is chairman of the Green Mountain Care Board, and he joins me in the studio. Welcome.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well.
So, how in the loop were you about the financial models that were being considered for single-payer health care before the governor made that announcement?
That was pretty much the governor and the governor's staff. There were a couple pieces of it, you know, such as medical trend that I discussed with them, but it was pretty much all their show. And so, you know, it was a pretty historic day for Vermont when that announcement was made.
Do you agree with the decision?
You know, what I'll say is that the governor did his research and could have easily sent his plan to the legislature. And Act 48 actually would have called for it then to go to the Green Mountain Care Board. And so for the governor to make the decision was actually a pretty courageous move on his part. He didn't have to do that. He could have said that he may not have thought it was the best idea, but it should go to the legislature. And for him to kind of become the lightning rod, I thought was a courageous move. Most politicians don't do that. I know he's been beat up about it and with a lot of the pieces of it, but you know, that's how I see it.
Given, though, that you are the chair of a board that was created partly because of the whole move towards single payer and something that you were going to have to spend a lot of time overseeing and regulating and thinking about, it must change your thoughts about the role of the Green Mountain Care Board and your role.
So there is so much confusion around who does what in health care and health reform at the state level, and you know, certainly that's part of this. So the Green Mountain Care Board has a big job to do that has nothing to do with single payer. You know, we are the regulators of the healthcare system in the state of Vermont. We're also the innovators for how we change the incentives for payment and eventually delivery of healthcare. And so we have so much work to do, and we were kind of doing it in obscurity. And single payer was a great thing to help that. And now we're pretty much the show. And so we have to make sure that that the work that we're doing goes on, is done at a high level, and can survive in the bright lights that we now have.
Well, remind people what the Green Mountain Care Board does.
Sure. So we are the regulators of the hospital system. So we set hospital budgets in an annual process. We do insurance rate review, where we review the rates that insurance companies propose for products, for example, that are in the exchange. We do approval for all of the capital spending in healthcare in the state, not just hospitals, through a process called Certificate of Need. We also have all payer rate setting authority, responsibility for universal healthcare budget, unified healthcare budget. We have responsibility for developing pilots to test reform in the state. We're responsible for the all payer claims database, which is a pretty awesome tool for health policy and health reform. So, you know, there's a lot of work to do for our small group of folks.
You said that there's so much confusion about healthcare, about health systems, about how this all works in the state house, among regular citizens, even among people who are in the healthcare field. Do you feel like you have a complete handle on all of the things that you just mentioned?
Absolutely.
How do you get up to speed on that kind of thing? If it's so confusing for everybody else, how do you manage it in your brain?
So the first thing I would say is that we have a tremendous staff at the Green Mountain Care Board, and they work hard, you know, every day to keep us informed. And the board members burn the midnight oil to make sure that we're on top of our game on all of these subjects. That said, and I've joked publicly that my cooks think I worked on Vermont Health Connect, you know, the software. You know, the Green Mountain Care Board, that wasn't our role. Our job was to define the benefit for Vermont Health Connect, but certainly not the software.
You didn't build out the website.
No, yeah. No. But so I've actually stopped even correcting my cooks, and now I just tell them what's going on. So it's hard to get the message out about who does what because our healthcare system is so large. You know, when folks say that it's, you know, 19% of GDP, there's no scale to that. No one has any, well, what does that mean? You know, so the entire U.S. military is only 4.5% of GDP. You know, the energy sector is 6.8. The automotive imported and exported is 4.5. Private housing development is only 4.5. You put that all together and it's over 20. I mean, that's how big healthcare is in our state. And so we should assume that there's going to be confusion. We should not be surprised by it.
We're talking with Al Gobay, chairman of the Green Mountain Care Board, about where the board goes with health care reform now. It was created as part of Governor Shumlin's plan to build a single-payer health care system in the state of Vermont. But the board's work isn't over just because that plan has been shelved by the governor. Gobay is telling us about the work the board continues to do, where he'd like to see payment reform and budgeting move in the future. And listeners, if you have a question for him, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to Paula, who's calling in from Enosburg Falls. Hi, Paula. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I listened to Al Gobay talk before the Joint Health Committees yesterday, so I know the Green Mountain Care Board has a lot on its plate to do. And I was wondering how much will the cost shift proposal that the governor is asking for contribute eventually to universal, affordable, publicly funded health care, which is still the goal of Act 48, and it sounds like it's still out there ahead of us and that we need to get there at some point just to be able to afford health care and have it be accessible to everybody in the state.
Paula, thanks for your question. And just to recap Governor Shumlin's proposal, he's announced a plan to add a 0.7% payroll tax. And the idea here is that that would help increase Medicaid reimbursement rates. The governor says that would be a direct then decrease in private insurance rates. Al Gobay, Paula's asking about how that helps us move towards universal health care.
So, Paula, that is the real question to ask. Because the governor's proposal on the cost shift is the right thing for the healthcare system. You know, I stay out of the whole tax policy game because nobody wants the independent board chair vetting different ideas. Even in the VPR article a couple days ago, the governor had an idea and the Speaker of the House had an idea. So we don't comment on that part of it.
But in other words, whether you think the payroll tax is the right mechanism
or
to adjust
other,
the reimbursement rate
some
or something
other mechanism.
Else.
That's not our game.
But adjusting the reimbursement rates is.
Right. And so the question is that something we should be working on? Absolutely. The goal is a universal and unified system. The folks out there that are patients that, you know, that are just trying to get through their day and raise their kids and, you know, get their dinner ready at night are not aware of how complicated of a system we have created where some of the payers don't pay cost and other payers pay more than cost and the effects that that has on the patient. You know, so it's my personal belief and it's, you know, this is just Al Gobay talking that we don't want a healthcare system where doctors have to consider what type of insurance you have when you walk in to get care. We need to move away from that as a state and as a country. Right now, Medicaid, and it's true for dentists, it's true for docs, Medicaid doesn't pay enough for them to cover their costs in a lot of the services that are done. And so that puts doctors in the awkward spot of having to say, how much of my panel or how much of the business that I do can be Medicaid? And so the governor's idea, which is sound, tries to address that and tries to fix that. It doesn't go all the way. He's saying take Medicaid up to Medicare. He's not saying take both Medicaid and Medicare up to cost or some, you know, some big move like that, because that would take a lot more money. But so this is a step that we need to take to get it right, you know, between patients and doctors. It's also a step, and this is Paul, maybe some depth to Paula's question. It's a step we need to take if we want to build a unified system. It's very hard to imagine the disparity between Southwestern Medical Center, which has over 70% of its money coming in between the government payers, and 30% coming from commercial. You look at them, you know, and then you look at UVM Medical Center, and they're more 50-50, two totally different businesses. And you're not going to build a unified system if Tom D down in Bennington is struggling to pay his primary care docs. You know, so this is a step toward health reform and building toward what we call an all-payer model, where all the payers play by the same rules and have some level of reimbursement near each other. And so, you know, directionally, this is the right way to go.
You said, Al, you don't want to get into tax policy and sort of the nitpicking tax policy. The governor says about his plan that this should be cost neutral for employers that also provide health insurance already for their employees, because it should result – so they're going to get a 0.7% payroll tax increase, but – it should result in a decrease in private insurance rates. You're a businessman. Does that make sense on the face of it, how that would work?
It does make sense on the face of it. You know, if I put on my – you know, I am a business owner, and you know, if I put on that hat, I'd say there's some logic there. But as the chair of the Green Mountain Care Board, I'm in the awkward position of having to actually make that happen with the rest of the board members and with our staff. And so what I've said is that the governor's proposal – puts in, you know, I hope I have my numbers right, $140 million into Medicaid reimbursement rates, let's be clear. And the tax is about $90 million. Mm-hmm. So that's about 64%. $90 million is 64% of $141 million, or, you know, to be sort of precise here. The question is, can you get that $90 million back? That's what the governor's asking me. That's
right.
What the governor's asking of the Green Mountain Care Board. And the answer is, I think so, you know, and I've said publicly, you know, that this it's not logical to say you can't get any of the money back, and it's not logical to say that you could get absolutely every single dollar back to the commercial payer. But in the middle is the truth, and is the middle 64%? We would have to do a lot of work to figure that out, and I'll say this to Vermont: that work will be transparent, that work will be collaborative. And at the end, we will, like you do in math class, show the work. I also want to say that, you know, to the docs listening out there, you know, if I was a primary care doc who had a lot of commercial business, I'd start thinking, is Gobay saying he's going to lower primary care reimbursement rates? And this could hurt me. And some of the primary independent primary care docs are struggling now under the current reimbursement. The answer is no. We need to do it in an informed way with our values and our principles. You wouldn't just do 5% across the board. That would not be, for lack of a better word, smart. You really want to take a look at where you can reduce commercial rates and still build the foundations of the healthcare system that we need. And primary care is the foundation of our healthcare system.
That sounds like a lot of pieces that you're trying to coordinate and people to keep happy who want different things.
Oh, I'm not trying to keep people happy.
That's not
the job of the chair of the Green Mountain Care Board. I'm trying to make it so that we invest in the areas that lead to better health, and that we take a look at the areas where if you change the price, if we bring down the commercial price, because it's inside of a hospital budget, for example, then the actual movement of money would be even,
mm-hmm.
you know, so, you know, that's important to realize. Whereas for an independent primary care doc, there's no one to shift to.
Right.
Yeah. So we have to make sure that we don't do anything dumb here.
Well, I mean, on that, you said the Green Mountain Care Board is going to be very clear, very transparent. You will show the numbers. Is it as easy to be transparent and to see the numbers when you look at a health insurance premium rate? You know, you on the Green Mountain Care Board, you regulate insurance rates, but is there going to be a sheet that says, here's how the cost shift has impacted what we are asking for in terms of our premium rate this year that the Green Mountain Board has to approve?
So when you think about this, this is really, you know, people talk about the cost shift. What this really is a price differential. So there's a difference in the price paid for a given service in Medicaid and the price paid for a given service in the commercial world. And if you want to raise one and lower the other, you need to do it by all of the little fee for service things that we have in our current system. They add up to a big total, but it's it's a journey of 1,000 steps.
Sure.
And you can do that math, but you can't do it perfectly, and I want to explain why. It's just a pricing move. Price times utilization equals cost. So if we raise Medicaid price and lower commercial price and commercial utilization goes up for some reason, you will never be able to see this money in a real way. You know, you'd want to do it in a check or in a rebate. You know, that would be the way to really say, here, mm-hmm. you know, here, business community, here's exactly the number. But that's why it gets hard.
And that's, I think, why it's so frustrating to people thinking, okay, so the governor is basically trying to get buy-in for this proposal by saying it's going to be a wash in the end for businesses. But also, you think about it, I mean, a lot of employees contribute to their healthcare costs too. So as an individual, you may be thinking, I'd love a little bit of relief too in paying for my private insurance. But then, you know, what you hear from you, Al, is that it's not quite that easy and it may not be a wash.
Yeah, and I think the governor isn't saying that it's easy. I was
sure
at a meeting with him on Monday. 64% isn't 100%. You know, if we were trying to get 100%, I think it would be – we'd probably be laughed out of the building. But, you know, somewhere in there is the truth, and we'll have to figure out what that is. But back to what you were talking about, businesses should be upset right now. They should be upset right now because their premiums, and you just mentioned it, the actual patient's premiums are higher than they need to be. And we're doing that with a dollar that we only get a dollar for. If you put a dollar into Medicaid, that dollar becomes a little over $2 because of the federal match. And so when you talk about financing healthcare, we finance it in a whole bunch of ways in a really bad way. And so this was a better way to finance it. If you're going to have by the way, we just increased our Medicaid rolls in the household survey. If you're going to have a Medicaid population and you want to offer care to those folks, you have to understand the best way to finance that care, and this is the best way to do it. You know, it's hard because, every single thing in healthcare that you try to do, it really affects all of us, and we realize that.
We're talking today about healthcare with Al Gobay, chairman of the Green Mountain Care Board. We're going to take more of your questions after the break, so if you have one for Al Gobay, you can call 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we are talking with Al Gobay, chairman of the Green Mountain Care Board, about what his organization's goals are for payment reform, for hospital budgeting, and for the future of healthcare in the state of Vermont. We've been talking a little bit about Governor Shumlin's payroll tax proposal, but if you have other questions for Al Gobay, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Dan's on the line with us from South Burlington. Hi, Dan. Go ahead.
Hello. Thanks for having me on, and thank you, Mr. Gobay, for the work you've been doing. You mentioned talking about, you know, playing by the rules and fairness as far as reimbursement rates and things like that. I'd like to see a little bit of that ingested into insurance rates for individuals as a whole. I realize that's the third rail of community rating, but as long as we're going to single payer and as long as we're getting lumped in with things with everybody else, we're not treated equally. Everybody pays the same rates, whether you're staying healthy or you're drinking a six-pack a day. And we know what drivers are to health care costs. Some of the insurance companies offer a mild incentive if you get a physical and, you know, your cholesterol is low. But, you know, a small check, you know, a check for $300 doesn't really represent much of a reward.
So to ask the question about how can we use insurance rates to try to incentivize people to take some personal responsibility?
Yeah, actually, right now there is no personal responsibility at all, and it's kind of ironic here in a state in Vermont which prides itself on that. So
yeah, so let's put that to Al Gobe. What about that concept, and if that goes away, if we ever did move to a single payer system?
So I'm not going to answer it in terms of the single payer system because you know that's sort of been put to the back burner right now. But let's just talk about it in the world we live in because I think that would be more straightforward. So community rating and guaranteed issue were two things that Vermont did a long time ago that the Affordable Care Act just brought to America. And they're basically that, you know, it's the pre-existing condition idea. It's the idea that, you know, hey, if you're a woman between the ages of 20 and 40, you know, do we charge you more because you might get pregnant? You know, we don't do that in Vermont. We say we're not going to discriminate based on the healthcare we, through actuarial estimates, can figure out what you're going to use. So we do it as a pool where we're blind to who the people are in a large part, and everybody pays the average. And, you know, Dan brought up some great points. Other countries, you pay more if you smoke. You pay more, you know, based on other questions that you answer. And, you know, I'd have to agree with Dan that some of those things should be looked at. You know, whether it's through a check that you get back or if it's in a premium that you pay in the beginning, I don't think there's a good reason not to incent people to chase wellness. The problem is, and this is another point that Dan made, is, you know, $300 compared to your healthcare bill seems so small, but, you know, $300 is real money. So the actual cost of healthcare is what we're really working on. You know, when healthcare costs more than $11 an hour for the average single, for the average family of four, that's a tough sell. You know, so if you say it's that expensive, but I'm going to give you a little bit back if you don't smoke, it's a little bit on a huge number, and it may not be a good motivational tool. So
you got to sort of figure out the right balance.
We need affordability in healthcare first, and we can debate you know wellness and all that after. But you know that's what the Green Mountain Care Board's working on.
Let's go to Sheila calling in from Brattleboro. Hi, Sheila. You there, Sheila? Yeah, go right ahead.
I have a question of, there was testimony being taken the other day up at the State House, and I was wondering whether the Green Mountain Care Board is actually going to commit to using the full authority.
Oh, Sheila, you know what? Your phone line is so bad, we're having trouble understanding what you're saying. See if you can call back, see if you can get a better line, and we'll come back to you. Let's go to Timothy in North Ferrisburg while we wait to hear back from Sheila. Hi, Timothy. Go ahead.
Yes. My question goes back to a proposal that I worked on back in 2010 and 11. And what that looked at was that in light of an effort towards change, which my understanding is also trying to address a shift from a fee-for-service system to accountable care, is that it's very difficult to do that with the current environment where you have a complex system of co-pays, co-insurance, and in my mind, what is really not really, it's not insurance anymore. When you have a mandated loss ratio of 85%, you're just churning through a claims process, and that you really need to get rid of essentially the burn layer of claims, put in a high level of reinsurance as essentially the universal stop loss, and use a banking system under that stop loss, similar to what we see in what really is in the small group pool, where most employees are looking at high deductible plans, health savings accounts, and health reimbursement accounts through their employers, where what that would do essentially is means that people that go to the hospital, receive care, and receive a bill, then go through review process, or if you want to call it underwriting, where their ability to pay is then taken into account versus for the services that have been rendered to them, and that's where the Medicaid reimbursement come in. I find it very difficult to understand how we're going to be able to see any significant change without addressing the fact that we have an existing system that really is extremely cumbersome.
All right, let's put that to Al Gobay.
So what I would say first off is that the need for insurance for your insurance is not okay with me. You know, so these high deductible plans are and they're just realize high deductible plans are just a reflection of the overall price. As you know, healthcare costs have risen over the last 15 years. More and more has been put into the deductible, and it's just simply a reflection of price. But Timothy, the whole question you're framing is, I believe, is how do we get the incentives right in healthcare? You know, so basically, you have insurance companies and payers that wake up every single day hoping that people are healthy. Because they've already collected their monthly money, and the more people are sick, the faster that gets drawn down. And that's their business model. We, you know, judge it or don't judge it, but that's the truth. Then you have hospitals that wake up every day that need to find revenue. And until we reverse those two thinkings, so that when John Brumstead, our local CEO, you know, here in Colchester, when he wakes up, we want him thinking about the health of the population he serves. And we're fortunate that we have a CEO in John Brumstead and in the other CEOs in our state, and actually to even include Dr. Weinstein from Dartmouth, that want to move to a population-based system. And so the training wheels for that are these accountable care organizations and these shared savings programs that we have in the state. And I just want to say that a point of pride for Vermont is that we're the only state that has a multi-payer shared savings program, you know, within our state. We have over 150,000 Vermonters that are through Medicare, Medicaid, and commercial insurance that are in an alternative to fee-for-service. It's only a beginning. And it's the first steps toward a unified system. And so that's what we have to get right. That's what the Green Mountain Care Board is actually working on.
Let me ask you a couple of quick questions in the time we have left. After the December announcement regarding single payer, Governor Shumlin said that he's going to ask the legislature to give even more power to the Green Mountain Care Board with the aim to treat healthcare like a public utility. Did you ask for more power? Do you want it?
I did not ask for more power.
Do you want it?
I'm a pretty informal guy, so what the governor has proposed would make our work more formal. And what I would say is that as we move from fee-for-service and a non-system to something that is population-based, value-based, outcome-based, and a system, you then need more formality. And I think what the point the governor is making, and I've actually not spoken to him in depth about this, is that recognizing that we're trying to work toward this systemness, we also have to recognize that at the point we have it, we will need formality. The timing and all that I'll leave to the legislature and the governor. But there is some merit in the points he's making.
Do you have a good relationship with the governor? Do you feel like you have to follow his lead, or do you feel independent?
I feel very independent. He has never, ever coached me on anything. And I think we have a great relationship. We have been through some interesting times together. We are very, very different people, and we've been able to communicate very, very well with each other. So I'd say it's a great relationship, but I don't see him that much. You know, we literally work in our own world. It's kind of the way it is.
I want to give you just 30 seconds to tell me one thing that gets you the most jazzed about what you're doing and where you're going.
Sure. So people ask me all the time, why did I do this? I mean, I own a company and threw my hat in to do this. You know, what gets me jazzed is the fact that when I started this job, there were people that worked for me that if they got sick, it could cost them almost half of their annual pay to be healthy, you know, to be healed, you know. And some of those people even had insurance from me, you know. So, you know, I'm motivated every day to try to build a unified system for Vermont. And, you know, I've said publicly, if what we propose and what we work on with our Coalition of the Willing, you know, if it's not what Vermont wants, we won't do it. But what if we can do something that's great for business, that creates a better health system, not a health care system for the state? Boy, that would really have been worth a few years of a little bit of suffering.
That's Al Gobay. He's chairman of the Green Mountain Care Board. Al, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to share the history of the ice ship called the Fram. That's next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The Fram was a ship that could go with the flow. That's FLOE. It was designed to float around for a couple of years, frozen to the Arctic ice. The Norwegian explorer Fridtjof Nansen commissioned this ship for a very specific purpose. Other polar ships were getting crushed by the relentless polar ice, so this ship had to be able to withstand the ice, and he built it to essentially float on top of it. The Fram was later used in Roald Amundsen's famous expedition to Antarctica, where he became the first man to officially reach the South Pole. Charles Johnson is a former Vermont state naturalist, a Coast Guard veteran, and a boat builder. He's the author of Ice Ship, The Epic Voyages of the Polar Adventurer Fram. Charles, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Jane.
So Nansen wanted to find out whether the Arctic was a continent covered with ice, a frozen ocean, an ice-free sea surrounded by a barrier of ice, or, as you put it in the book, a sea permanently covered with a shield of ice that would fracture and disperse in a crazy quilt of floes at its southern edge. How was this ship going to help discover the truth?
Well, it was the first and really only ship that was built specifically to deal with the ice. A lot of the polar vessels up to that time had been conventional ships that were just built up to be more powerful and more resistant to the ice. But the Fram was actually built specifically to be frozen in. She was built like a bathtub so that when the ice came to bear on the side, which is the most lethal approach, the ship would be squeezed up like a watermelon seed being squeezed up between the thumb and forefinger. So it would rest up on top of the ice rather than being caught. But if it were caught, it was incredibly reinforced inside. If the ice did catch the ship, it would keep it intact.
We're talking here about the end of the 19th century, and as you said, most of the ships at the time were being built to try to withstand that crushing ice. What gave Nansen the idea of having this ship to sort of go with it or float on top of it?
He realized that all the previous attempts to get to the pole failed, often tragically, with ships and men being lost. One ship in particular, the Jeannette, an American ship that was trying to find the pole through the Bering Sea, it got caught and crushed, and then bits of it, remains of it, turned up 3,000 miles away in southern Greenland. And he said, well, how in the world could these pieces make it that far over a three-year period? And so his theory was that the ocean, that the Arctic was an ocean with this drifting ice. So the only way in those days to prove it, at least for him, he was kind of a crazy guy. He was an amazing guy. He was brilliant. He was charismatic. He was handsome. He was the first man to cross Greenland on skis. He was also a PhD biologist, zoologist. His motto was "Gå fram," which means go forward, don't look back. So his idea was to, you know, we have one way to go here. You freeze the ship into the sea and you drift, and you drift, and you drift, and you hope you end up on the other side, which is would prove that the currents brought the ice from east to west across the Arctic basin.
So he commissioned the building of this ship, and then it was built, and he actually set off on this adventure, this polar adventure, to see if that would work in 1893. And what happened?
Well, he did, and he had 12 crazy guys to go with him that all volunteered. They had actually provisioned the ship for 5 years. They didn't know how long it would take.
So they had enough food to last 5 years.
They did. They did. But one of the things they did, which was unique, is they took a cue from the Inuits and shot and ate as much fresh food as they can on the way. Polar bear, seals, walruses, birds. But yes, they 13 men, the lucky 13 they called them, set along out from Norway, across the top of Siberia, Russia, made their way almost to the Bering Strait, not quite, and then intentionally froze themselves in. So they began. They began the drift in 1893, and for 3 years the ship wandered, sometimes backwards, sometimes in loops, sometimes forwards, but 3 years later it popped out east of Greenland, just as Nansen had predicted.
However, Nansen was not with the ship by that time. He said, oh, forget it, I got to go find the pole. I'm getting off this thing.
Yes, halfway through the voyage, he realized that the ship was not going to make it over the pole. It was some 500, 400 to 500 miles away. So he had this, again, a crazy idea of that he and one other person, one other man, would take sledges loaded with kayaks hauled by dogs and try to make it to the pole. And they provisioned these sleds with enough food for the dogs and themselves to make it to the pole. And then the idea was they were never going to rendezvous with the ship again, but they were going to make their way to the edge of the ice, eating dogs as they came back. And by the time they reached the edge of the ice, it would be summer, late summer, and they would jump in their kayaks. All the dogs would have been gone by then. Jump in the kayaks and make it to civilization. How crazy is this?
That sounds like a really not-so plan.
But what happened was that he realized Nansen may have been a great risk taker, but when he was beaten, he knew it, and he could not make it to the pole in time. So he turned around, and he and Johansson, who was his companion, made it to the edge of the ice, but it was too late for that year, so they had to look for a place to spend the winter. And they found an island. They were in kayaks at that time. They found an island, made a cave covered with walrus hide. They had shot enough polar bear and walruses to see them through the winter. And in this cave, they slept mostly for 9 months, sleeping in a single sleeping bag for warmth. And they made it through this long polar night alive and well, and actually gained weight from all of the blubber and the meat they had eaten. Following summer, they made it to another island where they heard voices, and it turned out that there was a British polar expedition on what was called Franz Josef Land, is where they had landed. They met a man named Frederick Jackson who happened to be there, and his supply ship took them back to Norway. And they arrived actually 6 days before the Fram arrived, having popped out of the ice.
So beyond the adventure of it, did they actually contribute to the scientific body of knowledge about the Arctic?
Nansen's, again, his primary mission was scientific, and he did. He did a lot of, made a lot of discoveries. For one, that the Arctic Ocean was very deep, over 10,000 feet deep, as opposed to what they thought at the time, which was very shallow. They confirmed his theory about Arctic Ocean currents. They proved that the Arctic was not a landmass or an open ocean. There was a long-held myth that the Arctic was somehow open ocean. If you got past this ring of ice, it would suddenly be open ocean. So he put all those myths to rest and actually was the first real thorough scientific study of the Arctic basin.
It's kind of hard to follow that story, but it was Otto Sverdrup. Did I get his name right?
Yes.
He was actually the guy who brought the Fram back to Norway after that first expedition, after Nansen left the ship. He was the one in charge. And
right.
He then was in charge of the Fram's second polar journey.
Right, exactly. Sverdrup was very low-key, very quiet, very circumspect. They called him the quietest man in Norway, and that's
saying a lot.
That's saying a lot. 2 years after the Fram came back from the first expedition, he took it on a four-year expedition in the Canadian Arctic. His interest was in mapping unknown lands, so he and his crew of 15, they mapped over 100,000 square miles of new territory in the Canadian Arctic.
The Fram's third expedition was to the South Pole, and the ship carried Roald Amundsen, who is famous and became famous from that voyage because it was on that that he became the first undisputed person to actually reach the pole. Why did he take the Fram?
His idea was, at least what he professed, was to take the Fram and do what Nansen failed to do, take it over the North Pole. So he convinced Nansen to loan him the Fram to do that. Nansen agreed, and he took off. He was going to make it to the Bering Strait around South America and do it that way. But right as he did begin this, he heard that two men, Frederick Cook, American, and Robert Perry, an American, had actually reached the North Pole. Whether they did or not is still up for debate. Evidence is that they didn't, but he didn't know that at the time. So he decided on his own that he was going to take the Fram to Antarctica to claim the South Pole because he couldn't claim the North Pole now. But he didn't tell anybody except the captain of his ship. And so they, with the men and 100 dogs, they took off from Norway and they made it to Madeira Island, 1,000 miles or more away. And there he told his crew, guess what, guys? We're not going to the North Pole. We're going to the South Pole. You can leave if you like, but here they are in Madeira, you know, off the coast of Africa. Where are they going to go? What are they going to do? They all agreed to stay. Also heading for the pole at that point, heading for Antarctica, was Robert Scott, the famous British explorer who was going to be the first to claim the South Pole. Amundsen knew about this. Scott had a 3.5-month lead on him, but Amundsen left Madeira and nonstop made it to Antarctica, and he was only a couple weeks behind Scott. And there was this stage, the famous race to the pole. Amundsen, with dogs and sledges and using all the techniques that the Norwegians were so famous for, made it to the pole, as we know, December 14th, 1911. And then a month and 4 days later, Scott arrived to find the Norwegian tents and then died. He and his men died on the way back, a very famous tragic episode. While Amundsen was on his trek, the Fram was out, spent 8,000 miles exploring the Southern Ocean and doing the first oceanographic work of the Southern Ocean between South America and Africa. So it was kept busy.
Charles, you actually traveled to the Canadian Arctic and to Norway to research mm-hmm. this ship. You visited the ship. You got mm-hmm. to run your hands along it. You got to see where those men slept on these polar adventures. You found hundreds of black and white photos. And it must have taken you years to write this book by doing all of that research. Why did you want to trace the life of this ship from birth to retirement in a museum in Oslo?
Oh, great question. Ever since I was a boy, my dad was a university physiologist. During the war, he was he helped develop the survival rations that the troops used in the Arctic and in the deserts. And he spent a lot of time in the Arctic working with Canadian troops on their survival rations. I always remember, ever since I was a kid, him talking about this ship, the Fram, and it's how oddly built it was, but what an incredible story it told. And he had in his library a autographed copy of Farthest North, which is Nansen's story of his trip. And I would take that out and leaf through it, and I would just be taken away. And when I retired, I finally had the opportunity to spend some serious time with this, what up to that point had been a hobby, side interest. And so I did go to Norway on two occasions to crawl through the ship, as you said. And I spent quite a bit of time in the National Library going through thousands of the original photos from the expeditions. And then spent, you know, a year and a half writing, solid writing. And so the whole thing took about four and a half years. But a lot of it was very pleasurable and brought the fantasy to reality.
Charles, are there ships that are being built today, do you think, that will ever earn the kind of reverence that you have for the Fram?
I don't know. There was something about, you know, a wooden ship of that era with the history that it had, you know, 20 years and three major expeditions and covering 84,000 miles in its travels. Still, a surface ship has been the farthest north and farthest south of any wooden vessel. So, there's so much history and so much imagination wrapped up in that ship. I would find it very hard to think I'd have the same affection for a ship built of steel of a much younger age. But you never know. There's many books written about ships of all kinds that obviously come out of the love and the attachment that the authors have for them.
Charles Johnson is the author of Ice Ship, The Epic Voyages of the Polar Adventurer Fram. Charles, thank you so much for telling us about it.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And that wraps up our program. Yesterday, the new leader of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Burlington was installed, and he'll be our guest Monday on Vermont Edition. Bishop Christopher Coyne will join us to talk about his goals of getting lapsed Catholics back to church, making amends for past child abuse cases, and elevating the church's social mission to help the poor. You can send questions for Bishop Coyne to vermontedition@vpr.net, and then listen to the program Monday at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Have a great weekend.